Good evening. I will call to order the September 19, 2022, the City of Kirkland Design Review Board meeting, and we will begin with a roll call.
Randall Brand.
Present.
Brad Brown.
Present.
Carlos Castaneda.
Present.
Shoshana Cohen. Shoshana? Maybe she's frozen. I see her there.
Fatima Cohen. Can you hear me?
There you go. We
there you go.
Yep.
Okay. So Fatima Cohen is not here. Tyler Smith and Amy Tarse. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Jeannie. So tonight, agenda. Well, before that, we don't have, in tonight's agenda, we have a special presentation for the station area plan and the conceptual design conference for, not conceptual, but design response conference for the Swift apartments. Do we have any member of the audience that would like to speak on any of the item that is not on the agenda tonight? Do we have anyone? John? Shay?
No, I think we're good.
Okay, then we will begin with the special presentation from Allison Zeit, Deputy Director.
Great. Thank you, Chair, and good evening, members of the board. Happy to be here with you tonight. This is my very first time having the pleasure of coming to the board, so grateful for your time tonight. Chair, can you see my my screen okay? Just if someone could confirm. All right, great. Well, I'm here tonight to give the board an overview of what the city has adopted related to the Northeast 85th Street Station Area Plan. I'm on the agenda for 20 minutes, so I'm gonna do my very best to stick to that. Gonna focus on high level things. Of course, I'm happy to answer any questions that the board has as we move through. But really, this is intended to introduce you to what was adopted. And then as we bring you items specific to the station area, we'll of course provide more background at that time. So with that intro, I'll go ahead and move through, and we're gonna focus on a couple key pieces as we move through. But first, just wanted to make sure to orient the board with why we did create a plan for the Northeast 85th Street station area. And if you'll allow me, I'll refer it to it as just the stationery from now on. So really the effort by the city started in 2019 after Sound Transit decided upon a design, both for a bus rapid transit line on 405 and then decided that Northeast 85th Street would kind of be a key station within that line. So the city decided to leverage that generational transit investment at Northeast 85th Street. And we had an objective to really maximize transit-oriented development in that area and try to create the most opportunity for the city of Kirkland and for our community members. The Northeast 85th Street Station Area Plan is a long-term plan. So this has a horizon year of 2044. So not everything we're talking about will happen immediately, but we did study out through 2044. And it builds on a lot of existing plans that the city's adopted, like the 2035 comprehensive plan, existing neighborhood plans that it overlays, and also functional plans like the sustainability master plan, several transportation plans like the active transportation plan, safe routes to school, and others like that. So we really took the opportunity to envision the station area as a demonstration district for a lot of these great functional plans that the city's created. We're really trying to bear out a lot of the visionary goals and objectives that we've adopted through those plans, like the sustainability master plan, for example. And I wanted to give you, because you're the design review board, I thought you might appreciate this, just a kind of a few pictures to show you what we envision happening in the station area plan. By 2044, if the form-based code, the zoning that we've adopted, and the design guidelines that we've adopted really bear themselves out, We want to take a place like the station area today, which you can see has some design challenges, being that we've got a highway running through the middle of it one way, and really a major thoroughfare of Northeast 85th Street running through it another way. This is an area where 40% of the existing parcel area today is made up of surface parking, with a lot of auto-oriented uses, and a lot of challenges, especially on the east side of the station area, for pedestrians and people rolling or biking. So the station area plan adopts a vision that we hope will result in something like this vision in 2044. So really introducing more density into the area and making it more of a people place, improving connections, and improving the relationship of the built environment to the street and the pedestrian realm. Just a few other of our renderings that we created, and these incorporate the form-based code standards that we'll talk about in a little bit of detail. This is a rendering of what we think Northeast 85th Street can feel like in the future, with more space for pedestrians and cyclists, more connection to the street. We really focused on existing sustainability and green resources in the area already. So Forbes Lake was really a focal point of a lot of our work as we tried to plan for the future, trying to think about how we could leverage that existing resource and connect more people to it. And so we focused some of our vision for parks and some of our planned investments on parks in that area, and then are thinking a lot about how we can get people to that. And then on the west side of the station area, we really are looking at the CKC, which runs through the middle of this picture. This is at 7th and 112th in the Norkirk neighborhood, or the Highlands neighborhood, where those all kind of meet. So focused on the CKC as a major asset that we want to connect people to, and also looking at that Norkirk light industrial zone as becoming something of a maker district. So to get to that vision, we have a couple implementing tools that I think will be of interest to the board. The form-based code, which is new to the city of Kirkland, but probably not to a lot of you in concept. And then the design guidelines. So I want to just take a few minutes and walk through a high level of what the form-based code in the station area adopted. And so that form-based code is really built around a few organizing principles, the regulating districts, which are the zones within the station area, street types, frontage types, so how the building meets the public realm, and then some standards that apply district-wide. And one of the things we did with the station area and trying to make it that demonstration district was we actually introduced some new base requirements required of all new development that will apply in the station area that don't apply elsewhere. So these are really focusing on what we need to do to make transit-oriented development work great here. And so among those new base requirements are new urban design standards. So really focusing more on frontage standards and being a little bit more detailed in how buildings meet the street. We have different types of transition standards here because this will be an area where buildings are a little bit taller than other places in the city, especially closer to that interchange of 405 and Northeast 85th Street. We have new mobility-based requirements. So we really looked at street standards, especially in relation to walking and rolling. So there are more standards for biking and pedestrian infrastructure here than might exist elsewhere in the city. We also looked at parking ratios. So there are lower parking requirements here so far that we've adopted than other parts of the city. And we also have new bike parking requirements here. And then on sustainability, new buildings in the station area will be required to be high performing buildings. That's a recent code that we adopted in the city. We also have a couple other sustainability factors, including a green factor, which relates to landscaping requirements. So the form-based code, as I mentioned, is really organized around these regulating districts, which are zones. We are looking at these this year in phases. And so we have adopted phase one of the form-based code, and that focuses on the commercial mixed-use district, which if you can see the color, it is the red area closest to the interchange. So it's this part on the west side and this piece on the east side. We're currently working to develop the form-based codes for the rest of the area, what we've called the phase two districts or the perimeter districts. We're anticipating adoption of those by the end of this year. So we're working on drafting those now. The form-based code is also built on street types. So the form-based code really starts at the street and what the street standards are for vehicles, pedestrian space, biking and rolling space, and builds out from there and is very intentional, about how the private realm meets the public realm and how we can make that a good place for people to be. And so that does require us to look at street types more in the zoning code than we do in other areas of the city and being really thoughtful about that. So just to kind of give you a picture of what pieces of the form-based code regulate what, the colors here relate to the colors you see in this building. So the regulating district is looking at kind of the big chunks of the building, the big cuts of it, the general massing and envelope. The frontage types, and we have standards for those, really look at, as I've mentioned, how the building meets the street. The district-wide standards apply to things like how we transition from different height zones to others, and also at things like landscaping standards. And then the design guidelines get into more of the details, like the materials and the articulation of the building. So it's just kind of another cut at the same thing. Again, we start from the street in the form-based code, and we work out thinking really intentionally about what's happening at the building frontage at pedestrian level, and then using the regulating district to make the big cuts to the building. Skip that one. So this is just showing the area we've already rezoned. And so this is where the form-based code is already effective, nearest the interchange. And so I'm going to go through, I'm not going to read through every line of this for your sake, or I definitely wouldn't be within my 20 minutes, but just wanted to give you an idea of what the form-based code looks like. And so each regulating district or zone does have what we call a development standards table. So this is really those main massing and envelope standards that regulate the buildings. So this is where we talk about permitted uses. We keep these more general in the station area with the form-based code than we do in other areas of the city, because the emphasis with the form-based code is really on the form of the building and not necessarily what's happening within it, as long as what's happening at the building frontage is still creating that pedestrian-friendly area that we're looking for. We talk about maximum lot coverage, required yards, so those general setbacks. We talk about the allowed height, maximum floor plates. So that's one way that will limit the massing in the envelope of the building is by regulating the maximum size of floor plates. And you'll notice that that's broken up. So the allowed floor plate size decreases as the building gets taller. We also talk in the regulating standards table about upper story street setbacks. So requiring buildings to be a little further away from the street as they get taller. Also talk about things like tower separation, maximum facade widths and breaks. So again, those are really the big cuts at the building in terms of limiting massing and envelope, but don't get into things as detailed as the design standards will. I mentioned that the code is built around street types and standards. I won't go into this. We have a lot of transportation planners that could walk you through this perfectly. But just to give you a flavor of what it looks like when we talk about the street standards and the form-based code, we are looking at what's happening for vehicles in the right-of-way, but also what's happening with furnishing zones for people biking or rolling and for pedestrians as well. The street types dictate what the allowed frontage types of a building might be. So those two things are tied together. Not every frontage type of a building is allowed on every street type. So you'll notice the applicable street types at the bottom, but we do have five different frontage types of buildings. As long as it's allowed, you can use more than one frontage type along a frontage or in one building, as long as it's allowed. And the frontage types get a little more specific, those development standards in terms of what's happening at that pedestrian level. So here we talk about the minimum height of that ground level floor, facade transparency requirements, a little bit more detail on how wide facades can be before they have to have a bit of a break, the locations of entrances, and also to start talking about where the building at the pedestrian level can push and pull a little bit to create more of a pedestrian zone. So this is where we get things that would allow cafe nooks and things like that. Also talk about corner designs and talk about, you know, not having parking pushed right up against. So this parking setback is actually a kind of a commercial depth requirement so that parking is right at pedestrian grade. So each frontage type standard has a similar table. This is the urban street edge one. Just to show you one more because it's really different, we have a plaza frontage type. It has a minimum area so that plazas we're getting are kind of meaningful at least. So there's a minimum size for those, making sure that they're a place where people can be and not just one big landscape zone or something like that. So we have requirements about how much of that plaza has to be accessible. So I won't go through all of them, just wanted to give you an idea of what those frontage type standards look like a bit. And then I've mentioned that the form-based code has some standards that apply area-wide or district-wide. One of the big ones for us was talking about transitions between zones of different allowed height. And so we did use kind of a combined approach. The transition standard applies when we have two zones next to each other with an allowed height of greater than 30 feet. So if the allowed maximum height is within 30 feet, you wouldn't trigger this transition requirement. If that difference is 30 feet or greater, though, you trigger it. We're looking at that through a combination of methods, requiring a landscape buffer and then also creating a sky exposure plane based on the allowed height. And then another one of the area-wide standards is talking about sustainability. I won't get super deep into this, but we mentioned here that high-performance building standard. That's something people can opt into now. It'll be required in the station area specifically, though. And then another thing that we did in the station area that's different than the rest of the city is that we looked at our landscape standards and focused on how we could really make them functional. So we're not just getting the plantings, we're focusing on getting plantings that are doing things like stormwater filtration or really increasing canopy. We're looking at soil depth so that we can get meaningful landscaping. And also looking at the types of planting, so focusing on native or drought tolerant plants. So that's kind of a point system so people through a menu of options can meet their green factor score, and it really favors things that are more functional. I did want to mention, because it could very well be one of the first projects that the board sees, and I'm sure you've heard about, and that is the potential Google office campus at the Lee Johnson site. And so that office campus is actually, we've been working with Google over the last couple of years, and the form-based code as we adopted it really encourages early catalyst projects to start to spur the vision for the station area. And one of the ways that we can do that is through development agreements. So the form-based code we adopted actually encourages development agreements on projects for parcels that are larger than 4 acres. So development agreements are voluntary contracts. They're not required, but there are contracts that can be made between a party and the city. The benefit for the developer is generally that they can get some certainty about what they're going to be required to do, as well as typically it can require or include some vesting provisions. And it also allows the city to gain some certainty about what kind of benefits we can receive from that new development. And so, the city council did adopt a development agreement with Google for that Lee Johnson site in July of this year. And this will be for the board. The development agreement will come into play when this project does come to the board, because the development agreement did adopt a few things that gave the developer and the city some certainty about what will be developed there in terms of how much office square footage and the size of those structures. And so the development agreement does include a very rough site plan. And so you'll see here locations of really maximum building footprints. The form-based code also allows, through a development it allows a development agreement to kind of tailor some of the form-based code provisions to the conditions of those larger sites, as I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with. it's really hard to write code for these bigger sites. And so the development agreement gives us a way to start looking at that and find things unique to that site that make sense and really still accomplish the goals and the intent of the code. And so just a few, I'll actually skip to the next slide because it shows a little bit better. A few things that the development agreement for the Google campus do in the development agreement is it gives us all a little more certainty about where heights will be measured from and what the allowed heights are. So talks a bit about where ABE is calculated, or average building elevation. For a couple of specific locations, because of unique topography challenges of the site, it talks about where exactly certain buildings will be measured from. So there's a pavilion building planned somewhere in here. So we talk about the specific measuring point to measure maximum height for that building. Also some unique conditions around this boundary of the site. So there was a slight adjustment to a landscape buffer requirement here. So those are the types of things included in the development agreement that we would of course walk you through in more detail when this one gets to you. And then lastly, just wanted to mention that we did adopt design guidelines for the station area plan. So these replace the Rose Hill Business District design guidelines in most cases that are within the station area boundaries. The design guidelines in and of themselves aren't significantly different than what you're already used to seeing in those Rose Hill Business District guidelines, but they do provide a little bit more detail. They include all the general things you're used to design guidelines talking about. The difference in the station area is that there is some differentiation about how the design guidelines, talk about different areas within the station area. And so we have four different character districts within the station area, the Rose Hill Gateway District, the Green Innovation District, Forbes Lake District, and the Downtown Gateway District that have just a little bit more specifics in them when it comes to the design guidelines. And with that, I'll wrap my presentation, but I'm happy to take any questions from the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. Before anyone asks the question, can I ask if we get a copy of that
presentation? Yeah, happy to provide that.
Yeah, that would be very nice. Thank you. And then does anyone have questions?
Yeah, I have a question about some of those voluntary agreements between some of the developers in the city and as well as requirements of some of the uses that will go in on the ground floor. I'm thinking about the south end of Kirkland Urban, you know, with the Google office building and the what's going in there, the movie theater that's going in below. And then just to the south of that, along Kirkland Way, is a separate building, but it's right adjacent to Kirkland Urban that has a PCC in it. I don't know if anyone's familiar with those buildings, if they've walked around them. But early on during the PCC buildings development, they had just a row of, you know, shops and storefront, you know, things that are pedestrian engaging running along that boulevard that's kind of, you know, right next to the Kirkland Performance Center leading up to Kirkland Urban. It would have been a really nice street. At some point, like their second or third kind of response conference, they changed their layout of their building and they had a giant, essentially truck, you know, drop off and, you know, all of their loading docks located right there. And they told us that, you know, a few of you on the board might remember, they told us that Google had changed their agreement to be able to get their trucks on this access alleyway that's between Kirkland Urban and PCC. And so they had to put their loading docks literally right in the front of their building. And it creates a really dead pedestrian space and really creates a break between this building and Kirkland Urban when it could have been a consistent connection throughout. I don't know if there's any sort of way to write into the code to require truck access to come off the sides and backs of buildings and to encourage or require shared access agreements, you know, through alleyways between buildings and different developments. But it'd be a shame if throughout the rest of the development of the, you know, this 85th Street corridor for the next 20 years, we get a lot of situations where if we want this to become a pedestrian and bikeable area, that it gets broken up by a bunch of developers who don't want to coordinate together and you know, just play nice with their neighbors. And it gets broken up by a bunch of truck access, loading docks and things like that. That'd be a shame. I have no idea how the city could enforce this, but I don't know if it's been recognized and discussed amongst the city planners on how to make something like that happen.
Yeah, I can take a crack at how we've tried to address it in the station area, and I am not familiar with Kirkland Urban. I don't know if John is, so I won't attempt to answer that part. But in the station area, we did think about it a lot, because part of what we were doing with the street types was looking at what kind of traffic is allowed on this street, looking at how many curb cuts might we expect on this street. So we tried to be really intentional about it. But it is a challenge, especially in an area that doesn't have a super fine network, a grid network of streets. We don't have a lot of options to choose from. And one of the strategies in the station area is certainly on those bigger parcels. We have identified locations where mid-block connections will be required. So trying to create more options within that station area, as we get development of the larger sites, we're getting more street connections, so more options for where trucks can access that aren't on those main thoroughfares. We did also include some design guidelines on it to, you know, give ourselves the opportunity, or you the opportunity, to look at that when we are looking at the design of structures of where access is being granted. I know the city is also working citywide on some more standards around where freight is allowed. Doesn't help buildings that just have to be served by large trucks. So it's not a perfect approach. It's a challenging one for sure. But those are the couple of things off the top of my head that we've tried to do in the station area plan to get at it and be a little bit more intentional and try to not have those surprises pop up where we're getting loading docks in an area we want to be really pedestrian oriented.
Okay, yeah, thank you. It's just something I wanted to bring to the attention, you know, of the city. I don't know if, yeah, there's an easy way to enforce something like that, but at least get it on people's minds.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. Does anyone else has any question?
Yeah, this is Randall. I want to kind of pick up where Brad was at. I fully agree with what he's saying, because we're facing the same situation up at the Bridal Trail Shopping Center, where they've got crossways that are, they can add two floors to the building, but they have to have these pedestrian connectors crossing the property, but you got two different property owners and they aren't seeing eye to eye. And so I see that as, you know, on 85th Street, that same thing as Brad is bringing up, because the Kirkland Urban and in the apartment building that's got PCC in it, one of the first projects that I was on the board with, they called that street along there a pedestrian promenade. And we ended up with a huge opening for getting into a parking garage, but then it also ended up to be the service entrance for PCC and a grocery store that has 15, 17, 20 trucks a day that show up. And so in looking at that, as you look at these street definitions and how you're putting that together, and then how these, you know, you've got development agreements, but, you know, I agree. Is there some way that the city, and this would be, can go back to council or go back to planning and really look at this and say, if landlords are working together in a connective type deal, they may get some credits for something. I don't know what that would be, but to really get them to connect, because the critical issue, and it's what we're seeing at Houghton and what we do see at Kirkland Urban to that south project, is that then they just don't connect there. You can definitely see it just runs up to the property line and the next building takes off, and it's just not a fluid flow that really works very well. And so I echo what Brad is saying, is that we're seeing it more and more, or we have seen it on projects right now. And if there's a way that as you're going through this area plan and really looking at that, is to look at those points and see if there isn't a way to solve that, you know, solve that issue.
Yeah, thank you for that. I really do appreciate the emphasis, because as we kind of get into this more urban model, certainly it will be a change in the Rose Hill area. It is a difficult one. I think the good news for the station area, at least, is that we are still working on the zoning for the majority of the land area. And so we can certainly take a closer look. We do have the design guidelines for the full area adopted. They do have some mention of kind of the design of the loading zones and where they are. But I think that looking at if there's anything more specific we can get to is something we can explore as we work on the draft zoning for those perimeter districts.
Good. That's all I had, just to kind of echo what Brad was saying.
Sorry, can you hear me? I'm not sure my internet connection is very good tonight, so if I'm breaking up, I'm sorry in advance.
I can hear you.
Okay, good. So does anyone else have something to add? Fatima, are you raising your hand? Okay. So how does it work now after the staff presentation and the comments that we heard from the board members? Do we have like a follow-up session? Do we get some sort of, you know, response, or do we continue this conversation at all?
Now, I think at this point, Shoshana, this is just really just a heads up for the board. Mm-hmm. As Ali mentioned, I think Google is probably going to be the next project that the board's going to see regarding this area. So once that actually comes through and we get an application, I think at that point, you know, the first step is the conceptual conference. So I think at that point, we'll want to make sure we provide additional, more in-depth background regarding the area and the zoning and so forth and the guidelines, so that the board can be well informed as far as providing direction. So this is really meant to be just a kind of introductory to this area presentation.
Okay, and we will get a copy of your presentation and guidelines so we can have enough time in advance to prepare and work with that. Okay, well, thank you very much, Allison.
Yeah, thank you all for your time.
Seeing no other questions, I believe it's our turn. We turn to Aoife to continue the conversation about the Design Response Conference for the Swift Apartments.
Yes, thank you. I'm just going to set up my presentation. Screen. Okay, good evening, everyone. I'm taking you all can see my screen. Okay, my name is Aoife Blake. I'm an associate planner at the City of Kirkland. And tonight we are here for the continuation of a design response conference for the Swift Apartments. So just as a reminder, the subject property is made up of two parcels shown here in the corner of Northeast 128th Street and 120th Avenue Northeast. The subject property currently contains medical office uses and surface level parking. The site has quite a bit of grade change. The elevation drops from Northeast 128th Street to the village at Totem Lake property, which is down here at the south, by approximately 44 feet, with the biggest drop occurring midway through the subject property. In terms of zoning, the site is located in the TL1A zone, where the maximum height allowed is 160 feet above average building elevation. Surrounding the site, we have to the north and west TL1A, so the same zone and the same height allowance. To the south and east is TL2, which has 135 foot height allowance. And then to the east, we have TL3B, it's an institutional zone, 150 feet above average building elevation is the height allowed there. We are here tonight, as I mentioned, to continue the design response conference from August 4th. The board should provide feedback to the applicant on the items that were discussed at that meeting. Just a note on where we are in the process. This project is in the design review phase, which is made up of two parts, conceptual design conference and design response. We are here at the design response conference stage. The project is also required to get some other permits and approvals, like the SEPA review, which looks at environmental impacts of the project, and a parking review also. And of course, then we're going to be having grading and building permits. So the project consists of an 8 to 16 story mixed use building with approximately 313 residential units and 50,000 square feet of medical office space, with parking in a structure below the building. Vehicular access is proposed from Northeast 128th Street and from an access easement on the Village of Totem Lake property, just to the south of this property. So as a reminder, at the August 4th Design Response Conference, for this project, the board concluded that the design guidelines around the scale of the building and the modulation techniques were satisfied. The color palette and materials were suitable and worked well for the project, and that there were no concerns about the rooftop amenity and common room space. In the next set of slides, I'll go over the issues that the DRB should provide feedback on tonight. So the first issue relates to the treatment of the garage wall that abuts 120th Avenue Northeast in order to satisfy the blank wall design guidelines. The applicant is proposing a mural on this wall, and they'll go into the design details further in their presentation, but the board should provide input on if this mural adequately treats the blank wall, and if the overall concerns around blank wall treatment for the project on this facade have been addressed. One of the main areas for the board to focus on tonight is how the project relates to the pedestrian experience. At the design response conference, the board requested the applicant to look for ways to encourage street activation and pedestrian engagement along 120th Avenue Northeast, and with the public plaza at the Northeast 128th Street entrance. The board also asked the applicant to enhance the entrance to the building at the southeast corner to make it more inviting and to fit better with the overall design of the building, and to provide an endpoint for the pedestrian through block connection required by this project. Just with regards to that pedestrian through block connection, it is intended for that connection to link up with a striped walkway on the Village at Totem Lake property. It was identified in the master plan for the village at Totem Lake to have that connection. I think some changes has occurred there with striping recently, and so staff will follow up with the property owner to remind them about that connection requirement. But regarding the pedestrian experience, the DRB should provide input on if concerns around street activation and pedestrian engagement have been adequately addressed, and if the public plaza at the primary pedestrian frontage of the building is sufficient in terms of function and design, and if the concerns about the building entry at the southeast corner have been addressed. The board also requested the applicant to provide more details around paving and finishing techniques, as well as lighting for the site. This information has been provided by the applicant, and the DRB should provide input on if these concerns have been addressed. The board also requested to see a design concept and materials related to the rail or gate proposed at that mid-block pass-through that will define private space versus the public space. And the applicant has provided details about this in their packet, and the board should provide feedback on this item. So tonight, the board should deliberate on the applicant's proposal and either approve the project, approve with conditions, or ask the applicant to return for another design response conference. If the board does determine that another design response conference is needed, please outline what additional information is needed to decide on the project. And I can take any questions from the board now before, or we can move on to the applicant's presentation.
Does anyone have any questions? Seeing no questions, question mark.
Sorry, Shoshana, I think we're having a hard time hearing you.
I think I heard if there are any questions from the board. And there weren't any, and then I think she threw it to me, but I'm not sure.
I heard the same, Mark.
I just heard
very
it,
good. Cool. Well, hey, thank you all again for having us this evening.
Mark, we're excited.
Yes.
I think that you can continue, Mark. I think that Shoshana is having some issues with connection, but just go ahead and take it away.
Thank you, Carlos.
Okay, Mark, I'm so sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes? No? All right. Again, thank you all. We're excited to be here. I think technically this is our fourth time meeting with you all. We're very proud of this building. I think as a result of our last meeting, approximately roughly 4 weeks ago, everybody was in agreement that it's a beautiful building. There are just some fine tuning elements that you all wanted us to work through. We've spent quite a bit of time iterating, evaluating, and in addition to some scoring patterns and some lighting, I think it came down to just kind of, I don't want to oversimplify, but really the northeast activation, the main lobby, the plaza space, and then the frontage treatment along the 120th. So we are excited to show you, and our package, our presentation this evening specifically focuses on the direction that we received from you all. And we're very eager to share with you guys, hear your thoughts. And once again, we are here seeking your support and approval for this amazing project. So with that, I'm going to throw it to Case at the Gensler Group, and we'll walk you through how we've iterated the building in response to your comments.
All right. Everyone can hear me?
Yes.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you again for your time and good evening. Really appreciate the engagement that we've had all along. I don't want to reiterate the eight things that Aoife, I think, really summarized quite well, other than to say those were really intended by the board to get at a finer grain of engagement that you were all concerned about, you know, making sure this building addressed the public really well, making sure that we really lock this building into the urban form and the patterns. And so that's really why we're here today, to seek your approval for those things. And I think we've got those here. So with me tonight are Jeroen Teeuw, my colleague, and then here to discuss the landscape from the Swift Group is Reese Van Bemmel. Okay, so we are going to jump right into this first one, and that is the hardscape scoring and development of materials. Reese is going to generally walk you through each of these three areas here that were requested to develop a little bit further. But before that, I want to talk about two specific items that were of interest. The first is the design of the gate, we had three gates that we were looking at. One along 120th at the mid-block area that we had shown previously, and then two at the back courtyard, one at the upper portion of the of that courtyard and one at the southwestern corner. And what we're looking at is a steel framed gate with then an infill panel that has a series of cutouts. Those are cutouts of birds, and we'll talk a little bit more about why birds shortly when we look at the upper portion of 120th. But those are really intended to be elements that are engaging, elements that really have a strong opinion of what they are. And in the case of the one along 120th, that is a sliding gate that would slide into a pocket that is formed at the adjacent wall paneling. The other two at the back courtyard would be swinging gates. Now, those are intended to be accessed by occupants of the building, either residents or tenants of the commercial buildings, and generally they would remain closed. The intention, though, is that they are really well integrated into the design of the adjacent area, and they don't feel as though they are excluding. And part of that is the way in which the adjacent areas will be designed to be open. And we'll go into that a little bit further when we talk specifically around that mid-block area. And then I also want to talk a bit further about the trees along the southern end of 120th. And I just want to put a pin in here that we'll pull out a little bit later. So please do recall these trees when we come to that area. Reese.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Case. Do you want to jump to the next plan here? As Case said, we're going to walk through some of the streetscape areas, those three areas, just to talk a little bit more about the overall design, paving, finishes and scoring patterns, and then some of the furnishings that are occurring there. Before I go, I'm Reese Van Bemmel. I'm with the Swift Company Landscape Architects, Swift with an I, not with a Y, just a coincidence that we're on this project. Before I jump into too much detail about this area, I did want to highlight some of the circulation requirements that we're accommodating in this area, as well as the topography. Aoife said already, there's a significant, I think it was 44 foot grade change occurring on 120th. That's a big site design influence because it really limits kind of where we can accommodate flat usable areas. The other big influence again is the circulation. So we've got a clear sidewalk running east-west to the neighborhood. To the neighborhood out to the west and to the hospital. Connecting across the street. We've also got a bike lane that terminates at our property and then ramps up onto the sidewalk level. Cyclists are going to have to navigate around that corner to connect to the bike lane along 120th. What that means is that this is kind of a busy mixing zone. It means we don't want to throw in a lot of fixed objects or too much planting. We want to keep sight lines clear so that we're not creating any conflicts. That's part of what you kind of see reflected here. Jumping into planting, pretty much along the whole frontage, we've got curbside planters about 4 foot, 4.5 foot wide. At the 128th frontage, we have proposed two large katsura trees. Those are kind of a larger street tree species. On the 120th frontage, those street trees that we've called out are actually happening between the bike lane and then the pedestrian clear sidewalk area in what's the city designated amenity zone, 4 foot zone where different site furnishings are occurring. Couple other things to just highlight for landscape. We've got a 5 foot buffer at the west side next to the Jade, just screening that garage entry driveway. Jumping to the main building entry, the overall plaza design is kind of a series of stepped or staggered planting areas with insertions of seat walls and timber benches, carving out kind of smaller scale gathering areas for smaller groups to gather and sit, as well as a larger overall open space there at the center. And you can see that that keynote B17 is kind of calling that out specifically as flexible space that, you know, potentially could have movable tables or furnishings populating it without impeding on all of those circulation requirements that I mentioned at the beginning. To jump to the east side just really quickly, so you'll see two, all those blue rectangles are representing cast in place concrete seat walls. There's two seat walls there that are helping to catch the grade as it drops off along 120th, because it's already falling at that point. And what that does is get us a little bit of a flat area at the main north facade and a small parking area for bikes there at the east, right where the cursor is, and a couple of seating opportunities as you're kind of rounding the corner there. On the west side, we've got a small gravel area that connects to a path that is an egress path out of the tower on that west side there, with some informal boulder seating there, and then some smaller trees and a native plant palette for all of these planting areas here. So if I were to jump to paving just really quickly, so the kind of lighter gray that you see through most of the clear zone is a City of Kirkland standard sidewalk paving with saw cut joints. So they'll have a nice kind of clean, crisp look to them rather than tooled joints. And then this darker kind of banded area that you see right at the entry is a special finish paving with integral dark gray color and mica in it, which is basically just at the surface, and it reflects light. So both during the daytime and at night, light will kind of bounce and create a glimmer effect. And then on top of that, we've also got a alternating light and heavy sandblast pattern at 1 foot bands. So really fine grain level of texture and detail there. I think the other areas I'd highlight just really quickly, if you look to the right, you can see what is that typical section along 120th. So there's a 6 foot plus clear zone for sidewalk next to the building. Then there's that 4 foot amenity zone, which we've got the street trees with tree grates and tree pits. We've also got the City of Kirkland standard light fixture running along there. And then in some of the later views, you'll see some pod seats that we've got populating that area, as well as bike racks. The bike lane itself will be asphalt. That is a city requirement. They've told us it needs to be that, with a 1 foot indicator band, which you can see there in the yellow, buffering the amenity zone there. I think that covers it, unless, Casey, you have anything you want to add or Mark?
No, I think you got
it. Yeah, let me jump to the next one. So,
I'll jump in here just to frame up the issue of the open space that was requested by the board to be studied a little bit further. When we talked in the past, you know, we discussed this as an opening in the middle of the block that would break down the overall length of the building, that would really create a respite for people either coming up or down the street. But the board, I think, keyed in on, well, what is the there? Where is the place that people would go as a destination? And so what we've done is to carve out a flat area that is roughly 21 feet by 12 feet in size. So a rather substantial area that is protected a little bit from the life of the street, necked down a little bit, and then opens up into a larger area where a number of people can be. That's then bordered by these cascading planters and bench seats that really go in to define this area. I'm just going to finish up my little bit. And then the gate that we talked about further, you can see reproduced here. That's the cutout metal gate that would then slide back and forth here. You can see that it's pulled back a little bit from the main portion of that that open area. And so its impact on you know, users of this area is a little bit further reduced. That plus the fact that we've got a rather open edge to this, I think really allows this to feel as though it's a much more open area than it is closed off and gated and separated.
Cool. Are you cool if I jump in? I just wanted to add a couple extra notes. Again, the grade issue is a big deal here. And that neck down, I want to call that out. We're trying to tie into a really steep condition. And the, you know, I think the natural instinct would be to open that up a bit. But when you do that, you create more of a warped kind of plane that you have to make up for. Just from a grading perspective, and it's bad for universal accessibility. So what you see reflected here is kind of better overall for getting a universally accessible space in that kind of flat new plaza area that we've created. Beyond that, I think we've already talked through, so there's that typical section along 120th with the sidewalk clear zone, the amenity zone, and then that bike lane and the planter next to the curb. In this area, we're also calling out that special finish paving, again, just as a highlight for users of the right-of-way that this is another kind of special moment in the building. And then you can see some of those pod seats. They're called out there with the B3 that are inserted kind of along that amenity zone in the right-of-way. Okay, so this is an enlargement of the west area. Just in case it wasn't clear, we started with north up, then we switched to north to the right, and this is actually, the north arrow is wrong on this. North is up in this. So this is an area with some substantial existing trees. We are keeping as many of them as we are able to. That aren't either within the building footprint or required to be removed by the North Shore Utility District. So you can see those kind of peppered throughout there. And in the previous presentation, we had some photos of those existing trees, if you are all curious, but it's some Douglas fir and some big leaf maple, and some of them are pretty pretty large. So you can see the stair pedestrian connection kind of starting up from the bottom, connecting up to the jade path, that is that existing path. I think you could probably guess by the number of stairs here, this is a really steep area. This whole slope is pretty much universally a 4-to-1 or a 3-to-1 slope. We are carving out a flat area where there is a connection to that MOB courtyard up at the top of the screen. And so that's kind of inserting, you know, as best we can, given the topography, a special, I would call it like a little mini plaza or a moment where there's a turn in the pedestrian path. And there's also some connections from the Swift Project building users from that courtyard out to the dog run area, which you can see kind of, there's a label there for it. And that will be enclosed by a fence. We've got an example photo of the product there. So it's a nice kind of wire, or not wire, steel fence. And then I guess other things to call out. So again, we do have that special finish paving occurring in that little mini plaza space there, some timber benches added. And then, you know, within the existing landscape, the best thing you can do for existing trees is to leave them alone, give them some water, and give them some soil or some soil help. So that's mostly what we're doing. We do have a couple small paths that let you kind of meander out into the landscape. We're looking at salvaging some of the trees that get removed and repurposing them as nurse logs or little landscape features throughout the site. So that's what you see there kind of peppered throughout there. The only other thing I would call out, and we'll talk about it on the next slide, is just that the lighting in this area are going to be tall light poles that are occurring elsewhere within the project area. They're not the City of Kirkland standard. Okay. So this was a slide I think requested at the last meeting just to help clarify and identify which light fixtures are occurring where within the site. So on the right side, you see the three main light fixture types that we have for the landscape design. And then we've also included a couple or a few of the building light fixtures that are providing kind of significant light for the site. So I'll just start with the site lighting fixtures, just starting with that S1 fixture. That's the City of Kirkland standard right-of-way light that we are required to use for this project. So that's happening at the 128th frontage and the 120th frontage, kind of all along at 60 foot on center. The next fixture type we have are these S2. So they're kind of a small bollard light, a little bit more intimate scale, a little bit more kind of a marker of a special place, I think. So those are happening at the north entry. They are happening at the mid block, and then they are happening at the MOB southeast entry. And then the last fixture is of the same family, but a taller light pole. And we have those in the courtyard and then along the southwest slope. And I think the only other thing I would highlight for those is just that using a taller light fixture is really nice because it limits the amount of conduit you have to run around existing trees. And it can get much better light coverage kind of universally. So I think it helps with that big stair run that's happening at the west side there. Just to talk quickly about those building lights, along the garage, we have this A1 fixture that's a wall mounted light fixture in the retaining or the building wall there. We have a special light fixture called out for the mid block area. And then soffit mounted lightings or lights on the south side there. So there's one at that loading area, that A4, and then another at the MOB entry at the southeast. And that is all.
All right. So I'll pick back up there. So here is the revised auxiliary entry at the southeast corner of the building. There's a request from the board to make it brighter, more open, and more welcoming. And you can see what we had presented previously on the left, and then what we're proposing today on the right. And you can see that that we've really worked to try to make it of a piece with the types of things that we're doing at the northern end at 128th. It's not the same. It's a different version because it's integrating into the mass of the MOB, but we're trying to use some of the same cues that we used up at the north. And those include full height glazing. So you see that here. The glazing is wrapping around that corner and drawing you up the street. The use of wood. So wood as a warm material where it's closer to the pedestrian. So we've got a wood look panel that frames that opening and really starts to bring the warmth down to the pedestrian level. And then an area that is covered. So this is around 630 square feet of space that's covered as respite for either users of the building or passersby. We've then we're showing a one fewer column from the left to the right. There's one column that's been pulled out and re-coordinated. So that is an additional way in which this starts to open up this corner of the building. We talked before about wanting to pull a pin out here, and that's where you see the landscaping that starts to work its way up the side of the building. We've taken the trees out here just for the purpose of being able to see how that building would open up architecturally, but then in addition, those trees will further soften the experience of the building for pedestrians as you. You sort of work your way up along to 120th. And here you see that further view, that the entirety of that streetscape and so how that all is going to work together. You've got the sort of engaging quality of this building at the corner. You've got the very wide and generous hardscape for both pedestrians and bicyclists. The amenity zone in between with benches, with light fixtures. And then you've got the landscaping. And again, remember that we will have these taller trees that you see here frame that side. So I think it's you know, really working on trying to create a rich environment here. So then we want to move our way up further along the building, along 120th. And last time that we connected, we shared a scheme for enlivening this area of blank wall that sits to the east side of the parking garage. And the board, I think, rightly, you know, had an interest in trying to figure out how we were going to really engage here, particularly around art. If we were going to provide artwork, what would that look like? What would the reason for it being, and how would that engage? And so what we've come back with you to you today with is a scheme that is really trying to get at the sort of reason for this building. It is named the Swift, very much after the bird. We together with the owners have had sort of a fascination with this really incredible bird. One of the things that's interesting about it is it does have these mass patterns of flight called murmurations that you see here at the top. And we've reinterpreted that today in a mural that's going to wrap that corner and work its way up the side of the building. That mural is using this rich yellow-orange color that we have elsewhere as accents and takes advantage of the ability to wrap that corner and draw people up the side of the building. It's a pattern that is a mix of geometric interpretations of that bird and then more literal and the way in which those two come together and create a sort of a moiré pattern from void to solid to void again really helps to, you know, create that pattern along the length of that street wall. So here's a view of the entire length of that 120th facade. And you can see how that mural is intended to stretch really from the edge of the concrete mass of the garage all the way up to the northern portion. And a blow up of that. Now the base of this is a textured concrete. We're seeing 2 foot wide bands with a depth of about an inch and a half. So that you're really starting to get depth in that facade, onto which is layered the painted mural that again transitions from more open to more solid to open again as you work your way up the hill. And then in addition to that, we've layered on a series of cut out and folded metal birds. And so you have the way in which this pattern goes from being two-dimensional on the wall to three-dimensional in a couple of places that really pop out and add further texture to that and really try to enliven the length of this side, this wall. That then connects into the gate that we had showed before. So the cutouts from the gate relate very specifically to the birds that will then work their way up along the length of this mural. And here you see that again, that corner where we were providing the open space of the mid block. And, you know, I'll sort of have you imagine for a moment what it would feel like to come up this hill, see this mural come into view as part of that draw. There's then an opening for people to come off of the sidewalk and under. And really start to engage with that plaza, some of the birds that would be along that length. And here you see it again. So as you're coming up the hill, that corner really acts as a draw and really starts to mark that area where where we're creating that destination mid block. And then as you work your way up, the pattern starts to change again. So the intention behind the art is really to engage passersby. It's not a, it is very much something that reveals itself over the length of this, of the mural, really intending to be experienced. And that is very much a part of how we're creating engagement along here. That art piece then acts in concert with the other items that are along the length here. If so, in addition to this mid-block area that we're opening up, we then have the plantings that line the length of 128th, both the lower scale and the upper scale, the site lighting and the site furnishings that really act in concert to create a really rich pedestrian area along the length of this. So we've included some of the additional slides that we showed last time in an appendix. If there are any questions that touch on some of the other items, we can definitely go into that. Otherwise, we'd love to have your feedback and hopefully an approval. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. Sorry, my camera is not working, but time for Randall. Okay. Can you hear me again?
Yeah.
Randall, would you mind starting?
Yeah, Shoshana, I got it.
Question?
Okay. Could we, just as a procedural thing, could we turn the meeting over to Carlos? Because you're breaking up quite often and we just aren't getting there. So I would suggest that we have Carlos take over kind of the monitoring of the presentation and that type of thing, if you don't mind. Just a suggestion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Carlos, I think that,
please. Yeah.
I think that's a yes, Randall.
Thank you.
So
yeah,
it sounds like a second.
All right, so I guess that it's time for the board to make any questions about the presentation of the applicant. Who would like to start, Randall?
I'll go ahead since I'm here. A couple of questions. I like the idea of the artwork and that type of thing going up the side of the face of that building, and especially going from two-dimensional to the three-dimensional. Though when you look at the two-dimensional, how is that applied to the concrete surface? Is that just a paint that's applied, or is it something a little bit different? I'm just looking at 5 years down the road, that whoever may be still owning the property at the time paints over it or does something. Is there some way that that's a more permanent form than just a sprayed on the system?
Yeah, Randall, you're absolutely right. It is conceived to be a paint, but what's in addition to the paint are the three-dimensional forms. These are effectively powder coated folded metal to replicate the form of the bird, and those are going to be integrated in the fixture within. So it would look strange if somebody at a point in the future went and repainted it for some reason. The cohesion wouldn't be there. But
is the background, is the concrete, what's the finish? So it's exposed concrete. So you've got an exposed finished concrete with the painted forms on it, which gives you a fighting chance to keep it, because it just would never match. They'd have a hard time painting the rest of the concrete or whatever they wanted to do. So I'm just looking at the permanent aspect of that and just making sure that your fine work, I really do like it, stays there instead of something kind of strange happening.
Yeah, in that. I appreciate that. And I think we could probably put a topical coat on it to, some sort of sealant coat, harder sealant that kind of more bakes it in and makes it less of a maintenance issue and more of a permanent fixture associated with the wall.
Yeah, we're certainly going to have anti-graffiti coatings for it to make sure that it Yeah, good.
Then the other question I have is, you could bring up the internal or the courtyard on the west side of the building where you've got the two gates that seal off that kind of triangular, that courtyard in between that and the adjacent building. Go to the lighting plan if you could on that. Okay. You noted here that you went to a much taller light pole in that area. And so when you go from the top gate down to the bottom gate in that area in there next to, you know, to the apartments next to it. And I guess I question that because of both apartment buildings. Your first couple of levels of the South Tower, I'll call it, are your MOB product and that, but the apartments next to you, by putting a tall pole in there, you got fewer fixtures spreading wider light patterns. And so how are you going to protect for overflow of light up against and into the adjacent apartment building? Wouldn't it be better to drop that down to a lower level and really just light the pathways from a lower perspective and not fight either your tenants or the tenants next door?
I think that's definitely something that we can that we would look at in the courtyard.
Yeah.
Especially where we're closer to their facade.
Right. Because a taller pole is going to give you 15, 20, 25 feet spread, and it's going to spread right into the building next to you. Plus it's spreading into your building. And I'm just not
the sure. Sorry, the only thing I would clarify is that courtyard is, gosh, I don't remember the grades off the top of my head, but it's sunken down below. There is retaining wall there. And so these poles are going to be about 12 feet tall. I don't think they're going to be projecting very high above the actual jade elevation through there. But as Kay said, I think that's something we can definitely look at. And I think the lighting designer as well is going to have to be paying attention to full cutoff, both for dark sky as well as property lines. So
yeah,
those are definitely considerations.
Excellent. I mean, the topography of this is rather interesting topography, how it drops and how you're handling that. It works very well. And that's really the only two questions I had on these issues, was that, you know, just protecting against the jade and then also your own tenants and then the permanency of the mural, but I like it.
Thank you, Randall.
Thanks, Randall. Brad, would you like to be next?
Yeah, I don't have any additional questions. I think they did a good job of addressing everything that I had concerns about last time. I was thinking the same thing as Randall about if that's gonna be paint. I was thinking at some point, as a transition from 3D to 2D, it might be like a metal panel that's like laser cut with birds out of it. I mean, I'm sure that's more expensive than paint, but you know, I'm just always concerned because that's going to be catching a lot of direct sunlight during the mornings each day that it might fade over time. And so just maintaining it, making sure it keeps its vibrance and in that appearance. But I think that this is a great example of how you can treat a blank wall, you know, that's kind of on a hill. It's not its own large object, but it's just kind of as it's growing. We see a lot of these sorts of kind of half blank wall, half sidewalk. And I think this is an excellent treatment of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Thanks, Brad. Fatima?
Hi, I don't have any questions, but I would just like to say it's really a really well done project, and I love the wall, and it looks beautiful, and yeah, gives the elevation a very, very nice look. Just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Fatima.
Thank you, Fatima. Shoshana? Is Shoshana still on the call?
I don't think she's on the call, Carlos.
Is there a question box she could potentially populate a text box if she had questions?
She might be trying to get back on. She's been hopping on and off.
Okay.
Sorry, Carlos. I was just going to say, Shay, maybe you can have Shoshana call in. Maybe that'll work through her cell phone. Carlos.
No worries. Thank you, John. Yeah, I don't know if Siri can get Shoshana on phone while I make my questions. Case and team, thanks very much for the presentation. I have a couple of questions. On 120th Street, the mid block connection, where the part where you, yeah, I think you can go back a few slides. Yeah, too fast. Can you go to the next one? That's fine.
Okay.
Keep that one. All right. Where the two people are walking out of that kind of like ramp that connects to the private area, it seems to be shown as some sort of lighting. However, that's not shown in the lighting plan. Can you just elaborate whether like that's going to be provided or if that's going to receive a different treatment?
Yeah, we would use that fixture has changed a little bit, and we would intend to use the soffit mounted fixture underneath there. So where it's covered, we would make sure that we have an A5 underneath there.
So it's not going to be a linear light. It's going to be more than okay. Correct.
Yeah, we didn't update that in the rendering, but it would,
all right.
It would be a version of this.
No worries. Can you go back to that view? The next slide, sorry. Yeah, perfect. So where the wall is receiving the treatment with paint of like these birds. I remember that we had some, that you guys presented some openings for the garage.
Right.
What is the treatment for that?
So we do not have those openings integrated in here any longer. We looked at a variety of different ways to treat this, mm-hmm. and came to the conclusion that perhaps doing fewer different things, but doing one thing really, really well would make a more compelling treatment to this facade. So the openings that we had there, we really felt would start to interrupt this mural in ways mm-hmm. that just wouldn't be helpful. And while not adding more, not being helpful, I guess to the overall piece. So those are no longer included in the project.
Understood. I feel that you guys use some sort of perforated metal painting on top of that, kind of like to mimic it. But
yeah, all right. Would just be too many different things, and we didn't think that was helpful.
Okay. Bear with me. I'm going through mm-hmm. my notes. So I guess that during the last meeting, I can't remember if we went into full detail about the other building elevations. Now, looking at the packet that you guys provided this time, if you go to page 55, I think the presentation is 46. Okay. We have the South Tower elevation. My question is, there's an area that is not clear to me. Yeah, go one back, 46. Awesome, yeah, that one. The South Tower elevation. So above that, I'm guessing that the space at the ground level is where we have the pedestrian connection path. But that South Tower shows an area as white. Just wondering, how's that facade looking like?
This area here?
Yeah.
So that's actually a cut through that's a section cut So what you're seeing here is a cut through the through block connector piece.
Right.
So this white here is the interior of the building.
Do you have an elevation where you're showing the exterior?
The exterior, this face here would be, so what we're doing is we're taking a cut through this portion looking to the north. So we're seeing this face here.
Oh, got
it. Seeing the inside face. And so what you're seeing was the white cut through here.
Understood. All right. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And last item, my agenda is, I think the staff flagged this, but there are some discrepancies between the layouts of the rendering of the rooftop and the plan. I'm wondering if that has already been revised for this presentation on how that's gonna look like.
This is the final here.
Yeah, the biggest difference that we have is that this counter does not wrap around the corner. There is in fact a door to get into the egress stair that occurs right here. That's the primary difference.
So can you confirm that's all the only change and none of the layout other than that piece is going to change?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. That's all that I have. John, do you know if Shoshana is back?
I don't see her, yes.
Yeah, so Shay reached out to her via cell phone. And gave her a link via her cell phone. So let's give her maybe a minute or two here.
Okay, should we wait or can we just proceed with the public comments?
Yeah, why don't we?
Do we still have a quorum without her?
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
We do. But as far as public comment goes, I think it's one person is from the applicant team and one is from staff. So I don't think there's going to be any public comment. Shay, do you have a status maybe?
As fast as it hurt. Phone can connect to her email, I suppose.
Okay, so maybe I'll just suggest, Carlos, you can go ahead and just start deliberation. And then if Shoshana is able to get back on, we can ping her.
All right, sounds good. Okay, well, let's now proceed to deliberation. Who would like to start? I think that there are like very specific items that we need to touch based on, which is the blank wall treatment, pedestrian or oriented, whether like the street activation goals have been met, the items that we flagged that are along 120th and at the corner of the building on north portion, and just landscape plans. If the revisions or comments that the applicant provided tonight kind of like satisfy our comments from last time. So anyone would like to start with this? If not, I'll pick Randall.
I really have no more additional comments or issues other than just that the lighting plan, protects the jade apartments, that they don't have something that's shining right directly into that area, or, either that or into their own, which mostly is commercial. So, that'd be my only thing is just to to notice that their lighting fixtures need to be such that they protect the jade property.
Okay. Do you find the treatment of the wonk wall good to meet just our comments from last time?
Yeah. I was not able to make the last meeting, but as I look at the blank wall and the artwork that they're doing, usually we're trying to grow something up it or something like that. But I think the artwork and the idea of the swift bird, you know, groupings and this type of thing, I really like that. It's very intriguing.
I know. I also liked it. And I have a question for the staff. Since this is perceived as artwork, is there a way that the board can approve for the applicant to kind of like maintain the artwork so it doesn't fade out with time or anything like that? Is there a chance that we can do that?
Well, I think the artwork here is it's like a condition that's treating the blank wall. So I think it's like an element of the design guidelines that kind of become a condition of approval for the lifetime of this project. John, do you kind of agree with the same?
I agree. And perhaps what we could do is just specifically call it out as a condition, because typically, you know, like let's say this project gets approved, we wouldn't normally call out, oh, you have to do XYZ, but we can certainly make it a condition of the approval specifically and make sure it's part of the building permit condition of approval for the building permit. And if ever there were issues with it, we can always point back to it very clearly. So I think that's one approach.
Okay. And I guess that now I'll give the word to Brad. And I would like to see if you are in support to approve with conditions the artwork maintenance.
Yes, I think something like that is a good way to, a good route, you know, to go down. I think for any project that has artwork installations, making sure it lasts for the lifetime and duration of the project. And then the one other thing that, you know, it's not necessarily a condition, but kind of just a notice to staff, looking, this is a great image as an example. I love the amount of glazing and light at the corners of all these buildings. And inevitably, we always see, just as a cost-cutting measure, they reduce the amount or sizing of the glazing so it becomes, you know, a much smaller or almost like a punched opening window that they can just install. And so I know that this construction type probably won't happen, but I just want to say, as the project moves forward, to keep an eye on reduction of windows and glazing, because that can always impact dramatically the appearance of a project. And it'd be a shame for that to happen to this one. But other than that, I think I'd be ready to approve.
Sounds good. Do you have any other comments about the street activation on the corners of the building or landscaping?
No, no concerns. No, I think the presentations that they gave us, that's kind of exactly what I was looking for, seeing, you know, what types of lights, how it was lit, how they're dividing pedestrian versus, you know, bike paths and the corner lobbies. You know, that's a kind of the level and expectation I think this board has set for all of its projects. And I think they've satisfied that.
Thank you, Brad. Fatima, what do you think about the project and about these very specific items regarding blank wall treatment, street activation, and landscaping?
I think they've done a very good job coming back with this presentation, and they've explained it very well. I love the idea of the wall. I love the color usage, and the street activities look good, and so does the landscape. So yeah, it's looking pretty good. They've done a good job at covering all the areas that we had asked them to. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you. Staff, do we have Shoshana with us?
Yes.
I do. Yeah, I am. Sorry. Woohoo.
Yeah, I guess that since we skipped, Shoshana, since we kind of like proceeded, we were trying to get you back on the call. Do you have any questions for the applicant?
I have to be honest with you. I missed half of the presentation. At the same time, I was very happy with what I did see and heard. And I hope this will set the standard for other applicants too.
All right, I guess that this turned into a deliberation for you as well. A couple of minutes ago, the board and sales brought up that since this building has a very particular artwork that is along 120th Street, we would like to propose to approve with conditions that the artwork that the applicant is proposing right now to be basically maintained during the lifetime and duration of the building. I don't know if you feel the same or you have any other comments about it.
Can we do that? Is it part of our authority to condition that?
Yes, staff has already let us know that we can approve that, and that is gonna be part of the process for the applicant.
So I am completely on board with that, and it's very important.
All right. I guess that I'll just wrap up saying that for the last meeting that we had, I didn't expect that the applicant would come back with such a clever idea about how to provide artwork where we have these really long blank walls. I think that the treatment that they are proposing is going to enhance the activation of this street as well as increase the quality, visual quality of the neighborhood. So I applaud that they did that. And I am echoing Brad, I think that the type of materials, the design that the applicant has provided today, I think that it really relates to this Totem Lake area, and the hope that this is or becomes a very successful project for you. I don't foresee any other issues that were brought up in the last meeting. So with that being said, and correct me if I'm wrong, staff, someone needs to place a motion. Seems that everyone is in line with moving forward with approval with conditions.
Carlos, before you jump to a motion, I just wanted to make sure that the board is also thinking about the southeast corner of the building. There just hasn't been any mention on that portion of the building during deliberation. And I just want to make sure everyone's okay with the material change and some of the other architectural changes the applicant made to that space.
Yeah. Randall, do you have any comments about it?
No comments. I like what they did from the last presentation, so I would approve it.
Brad?
Yes, the same.
Fatima?
Same, no comments.
Shoshana?
I agree with my friends, yes.
And I think that the material transition, even though it's not as impactful to the whole massing, it creates visual interest. Looking at the lighting plan, it seems that it's well lit, well illuminated, and but also relocating the sign that is not facing to the other building, but rather is facing to the street. I think that that's more inviting. So I don't foresee any issues with the design that the applicant showed us today.
Thank you. And I have one another ask. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I'll stop after this one. Just with making a motion and adding conditions for this project, I would like the board to add a condition that requires the applicant to submit a revised plan set that includes the changes of this meeting throughout their plan set. So some of the sections and different things hadn't been updated with this packet. And so it'd be important for staff to get that packet to issue with a notice of approval.
So you are referring to the rooftop area?
No, I'm referring to a lot of the sections and elevations in the appendix.
Okay. I guess that that'll need to be added into the motion that someone needs to do. And basically going to request the applicant to provide an updated package to the city depicting the updates to the previous information that we saw, not only these specific renderings, but to the whole presentation. Cool. And in addition to that, the motion will require to include the conditions with approval for the artwork that is along 120th, in which the applicant will maintain the artwork during the lifetime and duration of this building. Does that sound fair, please? So with that being said, would anyone like to make a motion?
I motion that we approve the project with the conditions as stated, as Carlos has stated to this point, and we approve to move forward.
I'll second the motion.
All right, move and second. Do we have to go one by one, Oif?
Yes, right. it's a roll call vote, please.
Okay, Randall Brand.
Approve.
Brad Brown.
Approved.
Carlos Castaneda.
Approved.
Shoshana Cohen.
Approved.
And Fatima Cohen.
Approved.
Thanks.
All right. It seems that this is approved with conditions. Thank you to the applicant. We really enjoyed your project, and I know that it took a few meetings to just refine this, but we're happy with the outcome, and we're happy that you guys are giving back to the community this wonderful project. So thanks again.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Next in our agenda, I'm trying to bring. So I guess that should we call for attendance for next meeting?
I would just say, you know, plan on being there on the October 3rd meeting. It will be the design response conference for the Polaris at Totem Lake. So this is the project just, was that north and west of the Fred Meyer gas station. We will do, you know, Blanca will do the call arounds the week before. So I think that's it on that topic.
And regarding the walk, are there any news about that, John? I know that you sent out an email with a poll to the DRB members.
Oh, yes. Gosh, I checked the other day and not everyone had responded yet. So please respond if you haven't already. It's Shay would have sent the email out and there's a link to a Doodle poll. So please enter your preferred dates. And we'll get back to everybody.
All right. And this is a reminder for all the board members that the intent of this meeting is to walk through some of the projects that the board has reviewed. And it's for everyone's understanding on how or what we approved and what was the final outcome of that. So as John said, please take a look. Takes 5 minutes of your time. And hopefully we can have this sooner than later. And I don't know if there's anything else, John, that you'd like
to. Yeah, there's just one other item on the agenda. It was just to have a brief discussion with the board about hybrid meetings for future design review board meetings. So I wanted to give a little bit of context to that. So the city council, see Mark.
Hi guys, thanks everybody.
Thank you, Mark.
So currently the city council holds their meeting in a hybrid format. So meaning the city council actually comes into the council chambers and has a hybrid meeting. So it's held virtually as well. And expectation there is that council members attend in person unless there's some, you know, I sent you an email, but unless there's some sort of special circumstance due to illness, et cetera, where the council member cannot make it or if they're traveling, that kind of thing. So the planning commission is wanting to take that same approach. Okay. So what I wanted to do is have a brief discussion with the board to see whether or not the board, the design review board wants to take that same approach, or if the board wants to maintain their current situation of a, you know, just having virtual meetings. So to be clear, there is no requirement or mandate to go in person currently. It's more of, you know, this is what's happening. This is what the council is doing. This is what the planning commission is doing. You know, and the question is, how does the board feel? Does the board want to stay as is? Does the board want to go in person? So really it's just to have a discussion, pros and cons kind of thing, and just to see how you would all like to move forward.
I guess that I kind of start with that. I feel, and I've been in in-person meetings and now online, I feel that the attendance of the board has increased due to the flexibility that we have. And don't get me wrong, I think that the in-person meetings were very significant since we had that connection with the audience, the community, and the applicants. But due to the nature of kind of like the projects that we've been reviewing, sometimes we take a long time during these meetings. And I don't know how everyone else feels, but I think that just being online gives us the extra flexibility of not having to commute and being more active on these calls rather than for X or Y reason having to travel and not attend. So I feel in support of like keeping it remote, but I would like to hear everyone else's comments about this. Randall or Brad, go ahead.
I was gonna say, I don't mind the in-person meetings. You know, in fact, I like them. Sometimes I do think that meetings last a little longer than they need to when everyone's in the comfort of their home. You might get quicker meetings if everybody's in person, but that's both a pro and a con. I didn't think about your point, Carlos, that people can attend more often or more easily. If they're able to attend remotely, that's a good point. I'd be okay for hybrid if people want to show up. But yeah, if it's going to be a requirement, I think Carlos is right. It might actually hinder some people being able to attend.
Thank you, Brad. Randall, do you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah. Sorry, I dropped off there for a minute. I don't know if the question is asked. John, what about public attendance? How does that work right now? If the city council, are they going to open the chambers for public? You know, the city council is going to be there.
Yeah, so, they have been. So it really is truly hybrid. There's some people that are in person and some people that are online.
Okay.
And you know, I mean, for the council and for planning commission, I think the purpose for them wanting to do it, a lot of it has to do with just being available in as many ways as possible to their know, constituents. So
I would have no issue with the hybrid because I've been having to travel quite a bit lately. So it allows me to join in when I'm traveling. But then when I'm in town to be there in person would be great too. So I would support the hybrid.
Thank you, Randall. Fatima?
I would like it to be virtual. It gives me the flexibility to be online at contend more. Otherwise, there would be a 10-year-old in tow with me to the meetings. So I would prefer if we could keep it virtual or give us the option that we can take the meeting virtually and make it hybrid.
And I think that what John is referring is that either we can stay fully remote or it can be hybrid. And correct me if I'm wrong, John, having some people online and some people in person from board. Is that what you're thinking, John? Sorry.
Yes, it is. And there's flexibility right now because I'm just kind of anticipating, you know, sometime in the future, it may happen where the city manager says, hey, all the boards and commissions are in person again, you know, just like pre-pandemic. So mm-hmm. right now we're in this kind of mode of there's some flexibility and it's certainly possible where we can try it out and see how it functions because we've never done it before like that. And how does it work in terms of board interaction, applicant interaction, and with staff? We can try it and just see. But the other part I wanted to say too was with hybrid, there are going to be some resource issues. So meaning we need to have staff that's able to run a hybrid meeting. So meaning someone has to be in the council chambers, someone has to be able to run the cameras and do all that good stuff. So if the DRB does decide to do a hybrid, I think it's gonna still take some time to figure out the resources from staff's point of view.
I guess that was going to be my next question is how is the electronic setup in the council chambers to handle hybrid? So
yeah, all the hardware is there. So like the cameras and all the audio, video, and it's just a matter of having someone there to run the show.
Does it, I guess I'm budget conscious. So I look at that and I look at the ability for the design teams to come in virtual and everything, especially when we got design teams that are coming out of Portland and all over the place. It really is a, lack of a better term, a sustainable way to actually run a meeting. So I would support the hybrid approach because I do enjoy the in-person aspect of it too.
Same, yeah.
Shoshana, do you have any comments on that?
Yes, I have a few comments. So just to understand better, so hybrid is only when you're unable to attend, or is it physically, or is it more like by choice?
Well, again, I'm going to point to the city council's model. So the expectation is the council members need to be in person unless there are circumstances that prevent them. So either you're sick or you have family issue, you know, family care issues, or you're out of town, you're traveling. So I think the default is you should be in unless there's a circumstance that would prohibit you from doing that. Because we still want to have you in the meeting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So first of all, I have to say that when I have the right for flexibility, I always tend to keep it because this is very important. I understand the value. I very well understand the value of in-person meeting. And it has the pros and the cons that, you know, everybody already raised, and I accept them. At the same time, I would say that to me, I would rather keep virtual meetings because they're working much better for me with my schedule, but I will follow the rest of, you know, the board members with their decision. I will respect that.
Thank you, Shoshana. And John, I guess that my next question is, how is that going to work for applicants? For instance, I know there are like some projects or some applicants that come from California or other parts of the country. Right. Are they going to be required or mandated to be in person at all meetings, or how's that going to work for them?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I think to Randall's point, maybe here's a question back to the board. It's like, because we've been in virtual now for a couple of years, and how does the board think, you know, the applicant presentations are going? Is there something lacking that you've noticed from since it was before the pandemic? So questions like that, because it really comes down to the quality and of the meetings and the presentations, and are what the applicants presenting coming across clearly? So it's that kind of thing. Is the board getting what they want in terms of the presentations?
I guess I can. I'll try to answer that, John. As I look at it, that as I sit here on my computer in a virtual, I'll have the city aspect of it, or the everybody attending, on part of the screen, and I'll actually have some of the documentation that we were given to review, and we'll be sit there scrolling through, looking at different points in more detail. And the presentation by the applicant is actually better than what it is at the in-person, because usually we get a small screen on one side, or you have to turn around and see the big screen on the back side. And so I see that we actually have more control looking at drawings and documents in a virtual aspect.
And I think that I'm just interested. I know that, Brad, you being the person that has been in the board the longest time here, you have seen and experienced a lot of in-person meetings, and you've been online with us for 2+ years. I don't know. I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say in terms of the quality of information and just how efficient has been kind of like communicating with applicants during this virtual environment.
Yeah, I can sum it up in a few bullet points. I agree with Randall. I think that the quality of the presentation is actually better online, because we aren't dealing with screens, and a lot of times people can't see it or facing the wrong way at the table. I think that the conversation is a little lacking online versus in person, because just open exchange and flow of dialogue, just it's just better in person versus online. I think we all kind of recognize that. And I think that in-person meetings are a bit more efficient. And that goes back to my, you know, I think meetings can tend to run a little long sometimes when people are, you know, online. And either that's because they're comfortable in their own home, and maybe when they're in the meeting space, they just want to get out of there quick. Maybe it's because people struggle a little bit more conveying their thoughts and ideas through online interchange. So I think that meetings are a little bit more efficient in person, but the flexibility of going online is better. You know, I've attended meetings, I think a bunch of us have probably all attended meetings from our office at some point when we've had a late night. And so it actually helps attendance when we are, you know, online. I've noticed a lot less public engagement when we're online. Although I don't think it's because it's harder to get online. I think it's just maybe because of the pandemic, or maybe a lot of the projects haven't been of major interest to the public for whatever reason. It's hard to believe, but that's just what I've seen. It seems like there's fewer people joining online than would show up in person. But those are my bullet points. So pros and cons to both.
I think I agree with you that public attendance has been going down. I remember that whenever we had in-person meetings, we had a long list of audience really making comments about these projects. Even we got emails about projects. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's kind of like the specific zone or like the areas where the applicants are proposing new projects that doesn't involve a lot of residential connection with the residential areas. But I definitely feel the same. I feel that we are lacking a little bit. We're lacking of public comments and the efficiency of meetings. It has changed. Maybe that's something that we all can improve, being more assertive and kind of like these design response conferences, not reviewing twice, something that we already reviewed in previous calls. But I mean, yeah, overall, I feel, John, that I guess that we need to get in line with the applicants. If we are gonna demand applicants to be in person, I guess that should be our responsibility to also assist and attend. So should be kind of like the same for everyone, I guess. And it also sparked the conversation between the deliberation, especially process. Because it's kind of like hard to intervene or to add whenever someone is talking during these calls, because you just like talk over someone rather than having someone in front of you and seeing that they are talking and listening to them, which kind of like makes more interesting comments and the deliberation processes. So I think that overall, I think that what I've been hearing is the majority is okay being hybrid, but I feel that there are some things that, I don't know, John, if you could clarify, I don't know if for this meeting or for next one, where like the applicants will need to stick to rather in person or online. And if it's, I feel that if it's online for them, wouldn't make sense for us to be sitting in front of a screen listening to them.
Right.
Yeah. Have applicants made any comments about what if they want to be in person?
Oh, you know, just kind of anecdotally, like before when we're sitting in the, you know, sitting in the waiting room prior to the meeting starting, like I've heard of comments about how convenient it is for them to just be in their office and then present. So to me, that's like, yeah, it works. But I agree, Carlos, it's kind of difficult to say, okay, board, you all have to be in City Hall and the applicants can be, you know, wherever.
Sorry, if we want to have the same type of conversations and discussions, kind of like among board members, I feel that we need to have the same conversation with the applicants. And if we are going to request them or kind of like mandate us to like go back, I guess that we all just need to be in line, making sure that that those real conversations happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if Brad's comment or question to you, I think that it was very relevant. But in fact, I'm more curious to see if you have heard any negative feedback from the community or from the applicants with this virtual environment, because ultimately they are the ones that kind of like give the final review on how well the meetings are being run or how efficient they have been. We are, I guess that all of us are interested to hear if there have been any comments that we can improve.
Yeah. You know, just in general, I would say no. I mean, if anything, the only comment I've heard is sometimes the meetings are running long. Yeah, that it's like to Brad's point, it does seem like it's going longer than before.
Yeah, but if I can step in, and John, I remember we have discussed that there are a few things that we are trying to kind of put in order to make the meetings more efficient, and that is something that, you know, should be our guideline for a meeting in general. And it doesn't matter if it's hybrid or in person, because there are ways to make the meetings more efficient regardless. This is how I feel.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong. And I really hope we can implement that.
Mm-hmm. John, have you seen a difference in attendance from the public? It seems to me, just from pre-pandemic, we had more attendance of public sitting in seats watching. Maybe they weren't getting up and talking, but they were there, to where in the virtual, I just don't feel that we're getting the public involvement. So I'm a little worried about that.
Well, I think just in general, Totem Lake projects just in general don't have a lot of people usually attending. I mean, even with Village at Totem Lake, it was pretty minimal. Yeah. And I think the primary reason is just, it's a very commercial area. And if there are residential, it's usually apartments.
It's renters, yeah.
Yeah, and renters. So I would say usually if it's a downtown Kirkland project, or I think the last one I can recall was 85th, the Continental project. Those had really high attendance.
Right. Lee Johnson had the best online attendance, and it was next to a homeowner residential area.
Yeah.
Maybe those are the only ones that generate interest.
I think so. And then with the Google, timber project, I think that one was low because, I mean, that Kirkland Urban has been in review for many, many, many years, and it was kind of like towards the end. So I think there's a reason. There's some rationale to it. So how about this? Oh, go ahead, Carlos.
No, I was just going to add that we also saw more attendance at Market Project, Market Street Project, small kind of like business with residential, on top, like the apartment.
So again, but that's single family.
Yeah, and I think that they were complaining about kind of like the current tenant kind of like having the trucks on there. But still, like, yeah, I think that the projects that have more attendance are the ones that are next to residential areas rather than these Totem Lake or bigger district areas, more commercial areas.
So I was kind of thinking about how to move this forward. And what do you guys think about this? Where maybe there, if there's like two or three of you that'd be interested in developing some draft recommendations. So both in terms of hybrid meetings and just how to run more efficient meetings. So what we could do is, like, if there's two or three of you that would be interested, I can set up like a meeting, some follow-up meetings, and then we can report back to the larger group, the board. And then, because I could see this where we can just end up making, some sort of a motion at the end of the day, as far as where the board as a group wants to head. Because there are some questions, because I truly believe that the board runs the meetings differently, and the whole dynamic of your meetings run differently than like a planning commission or a council meeting. And so I think it just needs a little bit more discussion too, just where we want to end up.
And is there any way to, for us to get, or for, I guess, that you guys to get the input from the applicants as well?
We could.
Just to understand, like, I don't know if like there's an active list of applicants that can provide some input regarding the outcome of the meetings, if they are satisfied or if there are room for improvement on certain areas, and if that relates to being virtual or in person. I guess that's gonna like really give us the final decision on whether like to stay hybrid or stay remote or be in person. And maybe like if the meetings are taking so long, it's not a matter of like being there, but it's a matter of how to run meetings and how to be more assertive on the comments. I remember that pre-pandemic, we had the Jurassic Parliament, that training.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Really kind of like helped all the board members, not only for the DRB, but the other other boards kind of like to understand the protocols, the motion process. So might be a good good thing to kind of like bring that back since we have new members now, and see if that can help help with make the meetings just more efficient, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I think Brad, you were going to say something.
Oh, just from my own curiosity, it doesn't need to take up any more time tonight, but you said that we operate differently than the Planning Commission board. I admit that I haven't really attended any planning commissions, but we're talking about the design of buildings and their effects on the community. And the Planning Commission talks about changes to the zoning and how that would affect neighborhoods, you know, and impacts, you know, to different districts. So how are their meetings run that much differently? I imagine there would be a presentation from the city or some planners about proposals to the zoning code or to the planning board. How are their meetings that much different? I'm curious how they're operating.
Well, to me, it's more of, it's like the design review board works in like a review capacity in a sense, where there's a lot of, are you consistent with it? So there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of, you know, maybe some interpretation on the guidelines, and there's a certain amount of expertise that you need to have. And so it's almost like in a review sense versus the Planning Commission, you know, you hear information, you get feedback from the public, and then you develop a policy. So there's a little bit different level of engagement, I think, where, you know, where all of you get really into the details of projects. And there's a lot of interaction and creativity and back and forth and suggestions. And so it's a lot more free flowing. And it reminds me of like a design studio in a way, kind of thing. So and it lends to a different form of interaction with not only the applicants and the public, where again, it gets a little bit more interactive.
Yeah.
So John, what do you think? I was just gathering some thoughts, and I don't feel that we are kind of like ready to like decide where to go in person or stay remote, but we can help you putting together a list of things that we all have noticed throughout this kind of like pandemic phase. I guess that there are like good points regarding effective meetings. There are some things that we really don't know in regards to what the applicants think about meetings. We don't know about kind of like the public attendance, what they think about that. And those are things that I think that I believe that you can help with to add kind of like to this list. And ultimately it's gonna be a sum of those comments or comments plus theirs plus the public feedback regarding whether like we should go back in person or stay virtual or be hybrid. And that's going to set the parameters to for also the applicants, because I really feel that we need to be in line with them, where like they go in person, we at least, I guess that we need to also be there, or we stay online and then they can have the flexibility of like taking meetings from any part of the USA. So with that being said, I guess that it comes back to your suggestion about making kind of like a list of items that you guys can discuss, the staff can discuss and evaluate with all the rest of the information. And let us know whether you feel that virtual or in person is better. And like, I mean, we did it before pandemic and it worked. So I don't know if like being now online is even better or worse. But I really believe that it's not only us for the ones that need to make like the final determination, but it, I think it's a sum of different factors that you, the city needs to kind of like also evaluate.
Right.
Can I ask, John, what is your impression about how the meetings ran, you know, virtually versus in person?
I think for me, because I've been doing this a while, I guess. I actually do like the in-person. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like it does run quicker. I miss seeing you all in person. And I just feel the interaction is better in person. So, but I mean, a lot of your points, it's like, I do think the applicant's presentation runs better online, which is kind of a weird contrast to how do you do that and get the best of both worlds? So,
I actually think hybrid might be, I don't know, almost the worst of both worlds as opposed to the best, because if some people are in the room talking and others aren't, it could make for people to feel excluded, and the people who are off or online and not in the room might still make a meeting run longer, so you lose the benefits of that good conversation. So a hybrid might actually be the worst option out of in-person or online.
I agree. Yeah, I feel that it's going to be tough for everyone to communicate part of the board being online and part of the board being in person. I don't think that's going to be efficient. And ultimately, it's going to be, I guess, that you guys as a city will need to make the determination what is most valuable, if kind of like the feedback that we've been giving is good or is superior to what it used to be, or if you kind of like want us back, which is that the board will need to understand that that's a requirement from the city and we'll need to manage it. But ultimately, I don't feel that it's just a straight yes or no question, but it requires multiple things to be kind of like compared before a determination is made.
Right.
So with that, do you still want us to volunteer for the lease to kind of like put together some of our thoughts and see if that can give you kind of like a path?
Yeah. So if you can, if the board members can just email me their, you know, pros and cons and maybe suggestions.
So,
that would be great. And then we can continue the conversation at a future meeting. Because what's going to end up happening is we're going to have to, if we go hybrid, we're going to have to develop some rules and procedures and policies. And that's going to have to get buy-in from, you know, the board. And I would say, let's just hold the course. Let's just stay virtual for now, because I don't think we're ready to just go hybrid all of a sudden. Please send me your feedback. And then what I'll do is gather those and then, you know, talk. So maybe what it is what I could do is pull in the chair, vice chair. So that'd be, you know, Shoshana and Carlos. And then once we get a good kind of list of what are the issues, pros and cons, and then I could probably, what I could do then is just set up a meeting between, so Shoshana, Carlos, me, and Adam, our director, and we can just talk this out and just see how to proceed. Let's just stay virtual.
Okay, so let's just like set some goals for these. Would it be okay if we send you an email with these kind of like bullet points that we find that can be beneficial or cannot be beneficial? Kind of like all our thoughts, so you guys can gather all those comments. And let's say, is it okay if we send them to you before the next meeting? Does that sound fair to you? Okay.
Yes.
So board members, I guess that we'll just need to make the commitment to find 15 minutes of our time before we have the next meeting and send John And who else should be on the email? Who else do you want on the
just
email?
Just me is fine.
Do we need to copy other board members, or it's only going to be you? Okay.
Nope. So please don't copy other board members.
All right, just making sure. So it's going to be basically sending an email to John before the next meeting, writing down all these thoughts that we have, whether it's good, bad, or it's the same, if we stay online or if we go in person or hybrid. And John, can you ask staff, I know that Blanca has been doing these calls, but for the two board members that are missing, to give them a call and let them know. Yeah. I know that sometimes email communication is a little bit tough, so it's easier if Blanca just gives them a call and lets them know that they need to kind of like send these before the next meeting, so you guys can get all the information.
And I'll see what I can do as far as getting feedback from applicants.
All right. Yeah. And if also public, you guys can gather some feedback from them. That'd be valuable, I guess, for the future of DRB and how meetings are run.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Well,
that's it.
Hopefully that's all in the agenda. So if there's
I make a motion, we adjourn.
Anyone would like to second that?
Yeah, I'll second.
Okay. move on second. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Right. Guess that this meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much for your time. And board members, please send the email to John before our next meeting.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night.